Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, August 10th, 2002. Today's session is entitled, Just War. Is the war on terrorism a just war or just another war? It is presented by Peter Thompson, and it is number THP-2002-07. Let's listen in.
This session, is just war, or is this just another war? Talking about the war on terrorism. And what I would like to do is kind of break it into three parts. First, I should introduce myself. I'm Peter Thompson. I'm on long-term staff here. I've been working in the Resource Center and in Carpentry this past winter. And in that role in the Resource Center, we did a lot of struggling and talking and studying about nonviolence and other things like that, and have shaped a community response to the war on terrorism, which is posted on the bulletin board out there, and some other written kinds of materials. Get ready to share what's on your mind and in your heart, because the way I kind of run all my sessions are not like sessions, they're more like forums. So I really would like to have everyone feel free to dialogue. And the structure I'd like to give for this session is, I'd like to hear how people feel and think about the present situation, the war on terrorism, our response to the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, the situation in Afghanistan, and the various stated things that our administration has talked about doing. Then I would like to look at just war a little bit in terms of basic principles of the theological concept of just war. And so do a little more like traditional sessions, sort of talking about that and getting some of those concepts down. And then I would like to have a discussion in that context about whether or not people think we should attack Iraq. How many of you were here Thursday night when I did the reflection at Vespers? Usually I, when I come to these sessions, I try to be neutral and pretty much facilitate, but it was time for me to get that presentation, so the cat's out of the bag on where I stand. But that kind of brings up an important point, I think. During, I would really like to evoke everyone's opinion and all voices, because it's obvious that our society is pretty strongly behind the policies of the country so far, of the Bush administration, by the polls at least. And we have a situation up here in Holden, as we struggled with these things the last year, that probably the people, those people were in quite a minority, in our winter community at least. And so we had trouble evoking that voice. And it's really just like, I'm going to go back down lake, we call it here, having been up lake for the last 14 months. And as I go down lake, I think I will be definitely in the minority and be a dissenter. And I know I won't feel as free about sharing or expressing my beliefs. And so we really don't want that dynamic to be in place here at Holden. We want to have a situation of trust. And so there really aren't right answers or wrong answers. There's just the question for us all to talk about. So I want everyone to feel free to participate and share your view. So I would really like to hear what people think. If we've been heading in the right direction, We've been heading in the wrong direction. It's very much a current event, so everybody knows the facts. And if you've been near a newspaper in the last few months, you probably know the current facts better than I do. So what do people think about the war on terrorism? Is it a good thing? Is it misguided? Do we know what we're doing? Is it the only thing we can do? Is a military response a good part of the mix? Who has an opinion?
I'm constantly struck by, for instance, in Iraq, if we were the people who helped to train Saddam Hussein into who he is. We were the people who armed him. You know, it was our government who kind of created, helped to create who he is. And in Afghanistan, we were the ones supplying arms to the Mujahideen and to Osama bin Laden and to so many, you know, groups there who are now considered to be our enemies. And then following the Soviet withdrawal in Afghanistan, we did nothing in terms of nation building or working with the people there to reconstruct a society. And it just strikes me that is so often the way we work in the world, that it's just this response of, you know, we go in when it's in our interest, and then as soon as it's no longer in our interest, well, you know, those evil people, we have to get rid of them. Or, you know, that so much of our foreign policy creates the situations that we then feel we have to rectify through military action later on.
So we've sold too many weapons around the world.
Sold too many weapons, and our foreign policy has been too self-centered on oil and anti-communism and so on, so that it has shaped us in ways that I think are wrong.
Does it seem like there's some improvement in nation building in Afghanistan to you, or not? In terms of, I know there's been some publicity that we're committed to stay involved and
it's
help build a coalition. And
I think it's been reluctant. Maybe other people have opinions, but I think whatever involvement we have has been sort of reluctant and following the lead of, like, other European nations and other, because it was the Germans who called together the initial grouping of Afghan leaders to determine the interim government. You know, the United States wasn't involved in that.
Yes. I have a real dilemma about the Iraq situation, and I think I don't want to pursue the Rumsfeld policy that's coming forward now. But on the other hand, where I get really torn is the other night when you referred to Hiroshima and our bombing there. And where I get caught is that I thought of, as you said that, at that time I had four brothers in four different parts of the world, all in military service with their lives being threatened, and all of the close friends and some relatives that I had already lost in that war. And so I guess, I don't know if you can relate what I'm saying to this issue, but that I think it then is very difficult to say, well, how do we combat what? And I know the other only quick thought I would say is that the idea of saying, well, it's very wrong for us to go into Iraq and just go ahead and say we're going to get rid of Saddam Hussein and everything. And yet, on the other hand, if any of what they're predicting happened, say, on September 11th or October 14th or whatever, we'd have the outcry, well, we knew better. Why didn't we do something about what we could?
One of your things was that the atomic bomb perhaps saved a good number of American lives, including maybe even some of your relatives.
What? Yeah, I mean, that terrible thing that happened did put an end to an ongoing tremendous loss of life. That's kind of this. That's why now, again, I think.
So you're ambivalent about whether we should do more military action now or not. think many people are ambivalent.
What frustrates me is that it isn't, World War II was kind of a noble cause. I mean, what we're being involved in now is oil. Mm-hmm. And every time I put gas in my car, I can't help but realize, I'm probably giving money to people who are going to hurt me. Mm-hmm. And I think the practical thing, because I don't know enough about Iraq to know whether or not, do they mean us harm or do they? I can't know that. I'm not a CIA, I can't know. I don't even really particularly trust our country's information. They're quite trying to split the So I just, I would like to see ways to reduce how much we use oil and hopefully get rid of it altogether, because that's, if they didn't have the money, they couldn't buy the weapons to harm us.
Yeah, can we trust, you bring up another thing, there's been very little tie between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. And I just noticed like a week ago for the first time they said we had intelligence that indicated that some Al-Qaeda members met with an Iraqi agent. Now I take it we get, part of the information third hand, but I mean, can we trust that information, or is that information now going to be leaked out to try and justify it?
I think it's going to be leaked. I think it's going to be used in just that way to try to justify a war, which I don't think should happen at all. I don't think we should bomb Iraq. I think it's ridiculous. I think that kind of violence in response to it's just, language is so powerful, and our media uses language constantly to manipulate the minds of Americans, thinking that we're not intelligent, thinking human beings who will question this. And, they just use the word Al-Qaeda. Oops, stick it with Iraq. Okay, now we have a right to bomb them. And it's just wrong. It's really wrong.
Bruce? I think it's so easy to slip into idolatry that we're called to love the Lord our God with all our heart, mind, and soul. And then if that's a reality, we're supposed to get everything we need after that. And it seems to me it's a matter of, do we have our faith in the words of Jesus Christ? Or do we have our faith in our own figurings, our own rationales, our own systems of security that we build up for ourselves? So I think war is sort of a symptom of idolatry. And to get to a simple place, a true place, a real place, we need to ask God to root idolatry out of our lives.
Say more about the idolatry of power or might.
Whatever gets there before God, if it's security and retirement, if it's sex, if it's ego, fame, whatever the gods of men are. But they all do the same thing, and that's called spiritual death.
If you plug that principle into the situation we were in when the Twin Towers went down, would you say that security or military steps had no place in our response?
I'd say let's look at our Lord and what he has to say about love's enemy.
And then out of that act.
Out of that and out of making sure that we address the God not being first in our lives.
It seems to me the war on terrorism is a public relations thing. I mean, we have a war on poverty, we have wars on drugs, we have any time there's a campaign, it seems to stir up people to call it a war. We had to react to the attack on the World Trade Towers, and to call it a war, I think, is a misnomer. And it would be absolutely insane in my mind to attack a country like Iraq. I mean, we had an opportunity when the at the end of Operation Desert Storm to remove Hassan, and we did not. We left him in power. It was probably a bad decision. We thought the Kurds were going to remove him and all that, and it would be crazy to militarily go in there again now. But that's quite a different issue from what the administration is calling the war on terrorism. They're stirring up people. President's popularity is waning slightly, but it's still, as you know, from the polls, he's still very, very, very popular, and he's going to play this thing to the hilt as long as he can get mileage out of the fact that he's fighting a war on behalf of the American people.
Where do you see the public relations part going? Do you think it's a political thing to keep Bush popular to extend the war, or do you?
Well, that's the way it looks. I mean, that's quite an accusation to make, of course, against the President of the United States, that he's.
Keep going, more here.
it appears that way. With the there's a lot of gun toters in Washington that seem to have the inside track right now.
I think one of the things that frustrates me, I don't fly that often, but I mean every couple months, and what I've seen since September is we're dedicated to spending more and more money towards going against Iraq now, but with just airport security, for example. It was very different after September, but now when I fly, I don't see much difference than what it was before. So it seemed that was completely reactionary and just meant done to appease the people for a short amount of time, and now we're not dedicated to putting the money and resources towards security within our own country that we could do before. I mean, we went, just an example, we were flying a month ago, and they're doing the random security checks now. Well, I went to check in, and she said, you've been selected for a random security check, so when you come up to the line later on, we'll be searching your bag. Well, what good does that do? I mean, you just told me that I could get rid of anything out of my bag I wanted to now, and I'll be fine. The random, I mean, you're searching two people out of 200. I don't know, it just doesn't seem like they're willing to put the money and resources towards that, but they are willing to spend it on more attacks and more war.
Before you talk, Bruce, Norman, the guy who's on teaching staff from Australia, the older gentleman, he came up to me and told me, oh, he's here. Are you here?
He
was here. He told me that he's now been selected four times in a row for random security checks. He's wondering if it is, he doesn't believe that it is random. So maybe he fits some profile. I don't know, Bruce.
I guess one of the questions is like I think I don't know your name, but
the gentleman who just
said that we had to respond to the Twin Towers bombing, and and respond violently or respond by bombing Iraq or Afghanistan, I suppose you're referring to. And I I disagree. I don't think that we had to respond that way, and I don't think we should have responded that way.
Mr. Because, can you say that?
Okay, I'm sorry.
I misinterpreted
that. That I think we should, as a people, advocate that our government take the route of love of enemy, what Jesus would do in this situation. And realizing at the same time that that seems like totally crazy and totally insane. But if we're going to have our faith in Jesus, then we can't have our faith in war.
Paul, were you going to... Was your response... Was it Paul?
Tom.
Did you think there should have been a military response?
No, I did not.
What, did you have an idea as to what kind of response we would should have done?
Well, one thing we should, of course, do is have a look at why September 11th happened. I have some pretty strong feelings about that. The laxity in our internal defense policies, our intelligence was frightful. There was it was inexcusable that we didn't know that this was coming. But it's kind of when somebody attacks you and hurts you, there's a human response. You want to get even, revenge. I talk about jealousy and revenge being such strong motivators in human beings. I think we just kind of desperate. We have to do something. We've got to strike back at somebody. We don't know who it is, but let's go after Afghanistan because we don't like the Taliban. And I suppose our campaign in Afghanistan improved the flight of people, but it's awfully hard to justify that kind of military action. And what can I say? I didn't vote for him, but 48% of the American public did vote for him.
Well, Jesus also calls us to love our neighbors and protect them. And we have a duty to protect them and to use force to protect them if necessary. We apply that action, for example, when there are gang wars and innocent people are hurt. And also, if we're supposed to love our enemies and not do any harm to them, you can't have it both ways. You cannot have it both ways. Now, a pacifist would argue that, for example, even with an order, that you pay the price for the lack of an ordered society, and even if that society disintegrates into despair, you still have faith, hope, and love, so that you should be able to tolerate or live with despair and let Hitler take over the world, let Japan go ahead and take over Asia. Live with the despair because you still have faith, hope, and love. It's always astonishing to me how history gets deconstructed, always in the light of one's own personal experience and personal mistrust of government, media, and all the things that are part of mistrust and the legacy of our experience in Vietnam. It doesn't mean that that's the whole world's tale and that it continues forever. There is information that's available, but if you cannot get all the information, you run into a sort of a logical cul-de-sac. You say, well, we don't have all the we can only justify going to war if we have reliable information. But We can't get reliable information, so therefore war is never justified. The war on terrorism didn't begin with September 11th. We were under attack in this country back as far back as the Nixon administration, when our embassies were bombed in Sudan, and we were also under attack when our soldiers were killed in Lebanon, and then all the embassies that were bombed in Nairobi and in Tanzania. Of course, only 8 Americans died there. The rest were Africans. And we didn't, what we did, we sent a couple of Tomahawk missiles into Afghanistan and destroyed some abandoned camps, is that what I recall? And the World Trade Center was bombed once before. So the war against us has started, has been going on for 25 years. And if we responded at this time full force, it was only because the American public was incensed, aroused, what have you. After all, the people who died in those Marine barracks, and so they were just soldiers, people that we have ambivalent feelings about anyway.
Why do you call it war? That's what I think that's a misnomer.
Excuse me, Tom.
What do you do when you bring in all these troops, and what else is it?
We'll come back to that, but Lonnie was waiting.
I'm sorry, I just had one sort of response to both of you. I agree with Mr. Tom that we have to look at why, but I don't think that we went back far enough. I think that why needs to go back a lot farther to how do people harbor such hate against us? There's a reason, I think, and I think that that's a lot farther back than the lack of security or how someone could possibly hijack using 19 people for a plane. And I think that the level of hatred had to grow over a long period of time. And so if the why question were to be answered or looked at even, it should go back quite a ways. And also that the war against us, which I wouldn't call a war but separate events, maybe would be what I don't know, has been going for a while. There have been separate events, but I think that also has to do with the level of their hatred against us and why that even exists at all, and to the extent that it does. So I was just going to say that. Thank you.
And if I can follow up on that a little bit, just in terms of how a movement can grow and how you can get more and more people who hate us to such a degree. I was in Tanzania 2 years ago this month, and this was more than a year before September 11th. And what the church leaders in Tanzania were telling us was that, because we had asked, we'd seen that there was a lot of Muslim influence in both Kenya and Tanzania, we asked about that, and they said, we're forming better relations with Muslims. We have this Muslim-Christian council that we've been forming with modern Muslims. They said, but we do have a real problem here with radical Muslim elements. And they said, a big part of what happens is that people come in from other countries, primarily Sudan, and they go into the poorest neighborhoods of Dar es Salaam, into the poorest communities where there are Muslims, where children have no opportunity to go to school, where people have little opportunity for advancement, where there is hunger and illness and so on. They said that's where they go in. That's where they do the recruiting. They open up schools, they encourage the children to come to these schools, and they say, look, you can have a free education for your son, and we'll give him a stipend with which he can help to support the family. And so they recruit tons and tons of these children in these extremely poor neighborhoods and so on in Tanzania, and then those are the children who become the terrorists. But there are children who grew up with nothing, children who did not experience, as you were talking about, the love of Christ through the actions and words and deeds of other people. They were children who only experienced suffering, who experienced no opportunity at education, who then were given an opportunity by people filled with hate, who then turned them also into haters. And they said in Tanzania they'd had situations of children from these schools. One of the first tests, apparently, of these children was to go to like a church and start mowing down people with machine guns. And, you know, but they, I don't think they could recruit if we all collectively cared about what was happening in Tanzania and other poor countries, for instance.
Well, there's some ambivalence about in our group, both in individuals and in different opinions as to whether or not we should have had a military response or a non-military response. Anyone else want to just speak to that, looking back at what we did in October, before we talk about the theological concept of just war?
Well, I've heard a lot of discussion about a world that I don't know anything about, because it isn't the real world out there. You could ask this kind of a question. What do you think would have happened to any American president who had not made a response after September 11th? I would say that it would have either led to his impeachment, or it would have led to some kind of a military uprising, because in 150 years of American nation, 175 or so, if we as a nation don't respond to this kind of, whether it's right or wrong, I don't think there is anything such as a just war. But if we haven't responded militarily, I don't think any president, any American president, would have survived 3 months. I just think that the whole realistic situation is that whether or not that was, whether Afghanistan was the best response, there had to be some response on the part of the president.
Anyone have a response other than a military response that you have thought of?
Well, I know I had sent an email to the White House just saying thank you for pursuing diplomatic channels, because I was afraid we were going to be in there bombing the day after. But they didn't pursue diplomatic channels. I don't feel as strongly about us going into Afghanistan as I do about us. I don't see how we can feel we're justified going to Iraq. I mean, I don't know if it's right if a kid, you know, is bullied, if eventually that kid is taught, you know, to fight back, but I don't think that the kid would be taught to ambush the bully weeks later. But I was interested. I have a dentist who's Somali, and we had kind of a conversation, as much as you can have when you're having your teeth cleaned, about a number of topics, and I commented that I was afraid that we were going to go into Iraq, and I didn't think we were justified in doing that. And he was commenting that he really was, I was surprised at his response. He just was saying how horrible the people in Iraq had it, and thinking that maybe if we went in, it would improve the situation.
I don't know if it's so much ambivalence as strong opinion. No, there is. I just sort of,
right.
When you said ambivalence, I don't think it's
right.
Quite the word.
Right. A split.
Yeah.
Somewhat of a split. How about, is there anyone here who had an idea or has an idea about a positive response to the World Trade Center attack that didn't involve military violence?
There's the there's a group that's trying to start the Nonviolent Peace Force, and although that, I don't know that that would work in the same way with Osama bin Laden and his crew, but just thinking of it in terms of other types of conflict, it seems like a real interesting type of idea. I read a book probably at least more than a decade ago when I was living in Central America and seeing different countries and how they were shaped by violence and by nonviolent movements as well. And I was struck by how much of a difference people committed to nonviolence could make even in the midst of violent situations.
I think a frequent criticism of pacifism is that it becomes passive as opposed to active, and there are not constructive, active alternatives suggested. And I've spent the last year reading lots of things, and it seemed to me that one of the good proposals I heard, we were here on September 11th, and there's a very wise gentleman who comes here sometimes, David Cleaver. He's a retired physician. And I'll never forget, I walked into the dining hall for breakfast, and we spent a lot of time talking. And I walked up and sat down at his table, and he said, "What we need is justice." And as I thought about that, I'm a criminal defense lawyer back in Minneapolis. I was a federal prosecutor and federal public defender, and I do a lot of human rights work. And it seemed to me that it wasn't a war, like this gentleman said. It was a criminal act by a group of 19 people, probably backed by a much larger group of people. And maybe it was just the lawyer in me, but when he said justice, and I thought of a very concrete path, that rather than dealing in rumors, lay out the facts, establish probable cause for arrest warrants, get them either domestically or from an international tribunal, and go and arrest the people. And therefore, I think you would build immediately, without going around and bribing other countries, an international consensus, because you would show the facts, there would be sufficient outrage, you would detain the people. If they wouldn't be detained, they might die in the effort. If they would be detained, you would have this wonderful cathartic thing that's going on right now at The Hague with Slobodan Milosevic. You would have them in a cage, and you would air all the facts, and they would have a judgment. And it would all be within the confines of due process, which I think would not be inconsistent with some of the Christian precepts that Bruce has been talking about, rather than having unilateral action and relying on, you know, just kind of random violent actions.
But Milosevic would not be in that cage had we not bombed Belgrade.
Well, you're talking about details, I think, about how you get a hold of people.
Well, it's on the ground, it's the same action.
Well, that's fine. I don't want to get into a debate about it.
Maybe another focus, too, could be to just let's bypass trying to get the bad guys, and instead be totally proactive and try to open up a dialogue where we would decide to listen to the grievances, and along with that try to respond in a positive and concerned and even loving way to the perceived needs of those people.
Can I play devil's advocate for just a second?
Absolutely. Thank you.
Suppose we listen, and what they say is it comes down to Israel. You stop defending Israel, you give us back our land, let us push the Jews back into the sea, or we're going to keep coming at you. I would not be willing to cave into a demand like that. If it is something that they want from us that maybe isn't quite right, where do we go from there? If they're going to keep attacking us even once you get past the negotiations or the truth of the matter.
I think once you start following a path of obedience and faith. Obedience and faith to Jesus Christ. Things open up. Things are created that were not there before. It's like the most creative thing you can do. But because we're so locked in sometimes to our own perceptions of how reality is, we refuse to allow the creativity of God and the creativity of Christ to build and create something brand new.
You just changed the conditions of my question. You didn't want to answer the question.
Okay. Would anyone like to answer her question? In other words, as I understood it, if a precondition to some discussions were a radical change in the Palestinian-Israeli situation that was unacceptable, should we accept that? In order to gain credibility or a start toward peace, should we just accept those demands?
Yeah, where should we be firm? Should we keep... Yeah, I mean, I'm just saying...
Do it.
I guess on a personal level, I've been asked for things I know I've had to say no to. And, you know, there was no creativity involved. There was, I had faith, nothing good came. You know, and sometimes the doors are closed. Sometimes you just have to stand firm and say to the bully, no, no matter what you do to me, I'm not going to give you what you want.
I think
let's go back to, excuse me, Bruce, just go back a minute. One thing I think we're talking about here is who's the bully. In other words, if you look at Yasser Arafat as the bully, he wasn't the person that attacked the World Trade Center. And so you've got a much more amorphous concept. So what I think Bruce is saying is basically try and make friends with the Arab world as opposed to, you know, because... The justice component wouldn't be exclusive of the trying to address the social ills component or to increase our security component or to cut out all financial backing for Al-Qaeda. Or, you know, you have a multifaceted... but how about this question? What if Al-Qaeda were a country? And the ruler of Al-Qaeda said, what we need to do is have all Jewish settlers get out of Gaza and the West Bank, and then we won't bomb you again. Is that,
yeah.
That's your hypothetical.
Yeah.
How about anyone who hasn't spoken have a view about that? I mean, do you draw a line in the sand and refuse to negotiate, or do you send out the bombers?
Isn't that Bonhoeffer's ethics?
The what?
Isn't that Bonhoeffer's ethics?
Tell us more about what you're thinking.
Well, isn't that what he faced with Hitler? And having to live in that anguish of how to respond in the face of such evil? Until ultimately he decided to be part of an assassination attempt. On an amazing power of destruction. Loci of evil.
And disregarding Christ's teachings.
Well,
thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not murder. That goes for Hitler, too. And that's a faith statement.
How did Bonhoeffer deal with that?
I don't remember. difficulty and with anguish.
Yeah.
And I think with hesitancy and with fear and with stepping out. If it's sin, doing it boldly for the sake of those who are dying. I am not an advocate of violence, but I don't hear anybody speaking of the courage of what it takes to be nonviolent. And I think it takes more courage to be nonviolent. I don't hear anybody saying, I'm standing up and willing to die for nonviolence. And look how many people died in the civil rights movement. Look how many people died in India. It's almost like we want nonviolence so that we all can be friends. But if we're going to put our our life on the line. We're going to put our head on the block for nonviolence.
And I don't think we have any, back to what you're saying, we don't have any history of people who have tried creative, not well Gandhi, but I mean, in terms of just whole governments doing creative, nonviolent approaches. Mm-hmm. So we all go, what could we have done? There was no other possibility except a violent response. It's because we don't know anything else.
There's actually a book.
Try anything else. And so I feel like there's something, that there's other options out there that we're all terrified to try.
Mm-hmm. I would disagree as far as models. Chamberlain, before World War II, tried peaceful things. That is a model of being rational with an evil person.
There's also the whole policy of containment of the Soviet Union after World War II, and Stalin and the containment issue. That was an American policy that ultimately worked out successfully.
Wasn't that premised on a huge nuclear buildup?
At the time that policy was formulated, the Soviets did not have the bomb.
But I mean, didn't the next 40 years, didn't that involve? I mean, I don't see that as a nonviolent model.
What do you call it?
Military containment, and it was basically an arms race over the next 40 years where everyone flexed their muscle more and more.
Well, there was also a great deal of economic containment. There was a refusal to have the Soviet expansionism further into Western Europe or into Europe. I mean, there was a policy of containment. It didn't go to war with them, even though those countries, like what was then Czechoslovakia and Poland and all those countries were, the only reason they existed was because of the presence of Russian troops, Soviet troops. As soon as the Soviet troops were gone, we know what happened to those countries.
We heard a pretty dramatic nonviolent alternative here in terms of the, what's it called?
Nonviolent Peace Force. In process now.
Yeah, a friend of mine from Minneapolis is helping set that up, and these people are trying to train what they will call armies, which will be groups of people who will go to areas of conflict and, as this gentleman suggested, the Bonhoeffer advocate, put their lives on the line. People were putting their lives on the line through Witness for Peace, like down in Nicaragua. They're going into northern Nicaragua and being down there because with North Americans and people of faith there, the Contra were unwilling to attack because they would get such bad publicity and lose the support of this country. So there have been some, but they've been, as Ricky points out, voices in the wilderness. It's not the way we think.
But the whole solidarity movement, that was a nonviolent, in Poland, that was nonviolent. It was huge. I mean, tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of people who came out and changed the government there. And, the Berlin Wall came down because, finally tens of thousands of people came out nonviolently. And there's a book called Nonviolence by Ron Sider, which gives a historical example of a whole bunch of different paths of nonviolence and times that it has been used to change governments and to change whole directions of societies. And that was before many of the examples of the last, 15 years or so.
Since we talked about Just War in the title, we better get there. At least we're having a great discussion, but maybe we can come back to it. I just wanted to mention some of the principles. It is sort of talked about mostly in a historical and now a Catholic perspective. There are the people who seem to wrestle with it mostly. I suppose that's because the bishops have their encyclicals and debate these sort of things. But it began in the 4th century. In the previous three centuries, Christians were basically pacifists. Almost none served in the Roman armies, and there was even a policy, if you had served in an army, for some of the rare Christians who did, there was a period of time, like a year's period of time after you returned from the army, when you would not take the Eucharist. The requirements that St. Augustine developed and then were later elaborated on by St. Thomas Aquinas and some other scholars are, and these aren't in the exact order, first and foremost was right intention, which I have down there as sixth. And that meant it was that the war would be, or the use of violence would be, for the restoration of peace, not revenge. And that, so that there was a purity of heart in terms of war is viewed, peace is viewed as virtue, war is viewed as a sin in these theological discussions. In order to engage in war, the only way it can be morally supportable is that if you are doing it not for military reasons, not for economic reasons, but with an idea to remove the sin from your adversary. So it's an altruistic motivation. Next is by a competent authority, which means, just getting a little bit to Tom's point about, you know, you need to have a sovereign decision. In other words, it has to be made. It can't be carried out by someone who's not in proper authority to make those decisions. It has to be a just cause. And that's number one up there. I think the biggest confusion during this time of the war on terrorism is everyone realized that it's a very just cause here because many innocent people were killed. However, a just cause without the other requirements doesn't, under the just war philosophy, become a just war. There have been other just causes and unjust causes for which we've gone to war, but it takes a just cause is only one of the components. Those are the three basic components of the theory, and then added onto it were these others: proportionality, just peace, reasonable
hope. What do you mean by proportionality?
Yeah, I'll go back on each one of them.
Yeah.
I just was proportion. So the ones that were added were proportionality, which means any good achieved outweighs the evil incurred. And it has to be of a last resort. In other words, you have carried out all of the other alternative ways. A just peace means that after the war, the people of the losing country must not be punished. And so I guess that would be like the model we have here of World War II and the Marshall Plan of Germany and Japan, where we go. Reasonable hope of success, in other words, whatever the objective is for the war, it's like something that can be accomplished. And finally, respect for non-combatants, and that is a real tricky one in this day and age with the weaponry and the amount of power that we have. And so St. Augustine counseled, here are his words: be peaceful therefore in warring, so that you may vanquish those whom you war against and bring them the prosperity of peace. There are arguments now that have been raging back and forth that just war theory is outmoded, that it, in the modern times, it's essentially impossible. But it is a thing that people fall back upon. And I found a current theological writer. He was a visiting professor. You can find a lot of stuff from the Pax Christi or the Quakers or people like that to talk about these things quite eloquently, but you can't find too many people to talk about the principles in support. But I found an article by Daryl Cole called Good Wars, and he is a visiting professor of religion at College of William and Mary. And when it came right down to his analysis, I said, either it seemed to me the efficacy or failure of his analysis comes to this point in his article. He said, how can we follow Christ while fighting and killing? Calvin gives us an indication by pointing out that Christ's pacifistic nature, his willingness to suffer violence at the hands of the Roman authorities and Jewish authorities, is grounded in the priestly office of reconciliation and intercession that is reserved for him alone. Christ's pacifistic nature is thus inextricably tied to his role as Redeemer and cannot be intended as a model for Christian behavior. No Christian can or should try to act as a Redeemer, but all can and should follow Christ in obeying the commands of the Father, and the Father commands the use of just force. So this is his analysis. So in our last, the bell's going to ring in about 10 minutes. Now we're down to Iraq, even though we talked about it for a while. But now you know about just war, and now you've heard the split of opinions as to whether or not we should have carried out a military response to September 11th. What do people think about Iraq?
Okay, getting back to this, let's leave Iraq for the moment.
Okay.
I just can't go along with this just cause. Because everyone justifies their cause for any war. What you mean is just cause by our principles. Everybody thinks that they're fighting a just war. And to me, at least, there's only one real reason for going to war, and that's to defend yourself. And if you're not attacked, I don't think that you're justified in going to war for any kind of political or as a crusade or anything else.
What if my neighbor's attacked?
Pardon?
What if my neighbor is attacked?
Well, there are certainly alliances, and we go by them. It isn't just the boundaries of our country. And if we've formed an alliance for mutual assistance and we're attacked, yes, that's we go to war. But I still can't let this pass without getting one more crack into it, that we're not at war. And we shouldn't go to war. And we're nowhere close to going to war. And the campaign against terrorism, the police action that we carried out in Afghanistan, which was reasonably successful, certainly shouldn't be called a war.
Self-defense is a part of the just war theory.
Well, I think that's the only
and
one that is
true. 2 weeks ago, I was out and I heard Donald Rumsfeld on the TV. And he has coined the term called anticipatory self-defense.
Yes.
That they are now talking about to justify the invasion of Iraq. And that's really based upon a talk that President Bush gave to West Point at their commencement. And he said, our security will require all Americans to be forward-looking and resolute and to be ready for preemptive action when necessary to defend our liberty and our lives.
Well, a lot of people bought that. That's what's so sad.
Well, so that's what they're talking about, is taking an action before there is an attack with the idea that if you're sure the attack is coming, it is self-defense.
First strike, very can't fire.
Bruce?
It would seem to me that we could take some clues from the history of Christianity, and especially those Christians that were closer to Christ at that than we are, by saying that what was normative Christian practice in the first three centuries is normative Christian practice. Because, primarily, it's congruent with what we have in Scripture. We either follow Christ and follow Scripture, and that's our guide and our God, or security. And the security state is our God, or war, or whatever is believed in instead of Christ's words.
I'd kind of like to throw a question out. Because on a personal level, I do believe in turning the other cheek and following those teachings very closely. I guess where I would like to hear feedback on is, should that be part of a country as well? Because I know sometimes the only way you get a person to stop hitting you is to hit back.
I think that's really a good question.
Do we apply Christians to a country?
I think it all comes down to you and me and our personal relationship with God, and whether that is first and foremost and primary, and through that being able to follow Christ's teaching. And that from, you know, us as Christians cultivating and praying for a better relationship with God, that's how things get changed. So we don't have to go and try to change the world, but get idolatry out of our own lives.
Well, I just have one more quick thing, because I don't know if that's good, but I just wanted to kind of throw something out there. It goes back to what was another option, or a peaceful option. In Peru, they have a mesa de concertación, which is like a talking table. It's kind of translated roughly. And after Sendero Luminoso, which was fantastic, that was a terrorist group that was active in Peru for a really long time, they form this committee and they go around and they listen and they take what people say, their experience and what happened to them. And through doing that and like being only people who care about the actual story rather than revenge of this large group that was impossible to find everybody. Through doing that, they made alliances, and this is part of the government. They made alliances with the people, and they were able to use the people's skills to get further in their investigation with the actual Shining Path, which is the group. And I think that it worked, actually it worked really well. And in gaining people's trust, or the trust of a country like Iraq or Afghanistan, that could help you to do your work, or to exact a form of revenge on people who hurt you without hurting women and children in the middle of Afghanistan who didn't have a lot to start with anyway. So I just thought that would be, if something like that were to happen, where you made alliances that were peaceful, and I think you can get a lot more done that way, and it's helpful for everyone to be kind of in accord and thinking of the same mind.
So the government in Peru listened to individuals, set up
a big web of people that were trained in like sort of being able to listen and explain things. And a lot of the people were in rural areas and didn't understand. Like, one day my husband disappeared. I found him the next day and he was dead, and you know, like all very descriptive things that happened to them, and I didn't understand why. And then they don't trust the government because so many people thought it was the government. Like, they just didn't understand. So in an effort to get them to understand and make alliances, because people weren't turning in members of Shining Path because they thought that they would be killed as well. So the government wasn't getting anywhere. So this table of talking table really gained the trust of their people. And I think that would be a better way to go about it. And that's it.
Thanks, Mark. Well, thank you very much. Anyone else have, is there anyone here? I didn't know if we had any votes to attack Iraq.
Well, it depends on what they've got, what's poised. I mean,
if they get chemical and biological weapons,
we know. I mean, so do we know? I mean, do we wait until they release those like they did on their own people?
Or will they release them only when we attack? If they have it.
Or
if they borrow Bush's anticipatory, whatever it was, that if we're talking about invading them, does that justify them invading them?
Anticipatory stuff. Yes, sir.
Just a point of clarification. The first just war was 6, 7, and 1 when it first was established, and then the others came later.
Yeah, from St. Augustine, the right intention, the competent authority, and the just cause were the three requirements, and then they sort of fine-tuned it with all of the others.
I think it's a great starting point, but as to kind of follow the system through to see whether or not is it the 2/3, is it the whole all 7? I mean, what's is it picking and choosing, or
no?
Does it fit all the criteria?
Yeah, you have to fit all the criteria.
That's right.
For a test
book. It was Ambrose who said that Crispin has a duty to protect his neighbor, even if it means, killing someone to do it.
Thank you very much for coming. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for sharing your opinions.